Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome. Every year, we do a program on Homeless Persons Memorial Day, a memorial service held here in Baltimore for all those who passed away homeless in our city. This year, we're going to read off and remember 113 people who were on the streets of Baltimore and died because they were homeless. And we come together with a homeless the Healthcare for the Homeless that sponsors this event. They're one of the most forward-thinking organizations in our city, an activist group working with people who are homeless. And this year we have in our studios their new CEO and president, Kevin Lindemood.
Good evening, Mark.
Filling big shoes.
Indeed.
Julia Hartenstein, who's lead organizer for this Memorial Day service, and a case manager at Paul's Place. Good to meet you.
Thanks, Mark, for your continued engagement in this issue.
And we're also joined by James Crawford, Jr., who was lead organizer of Be More Housing for All, a grassroots campaign of people experiencing homelessness in the city of Baltimore. And James, good to have you in the studio.
Thank you, Mark. Glad to be here.
Good to have you here. So we gather every year to remember those who died on homeless in the city of Baltimore. And it's always... I think it's almost hard to comprehend how in the 21st century, in a city like this, with all these abandoned homes, with the space we have, with the possibilities, that people go homeless, and that people die on our streets. I mean, it's almost, it's just madness.
It boggles the mind, doesn't it? In the richest nation in the history of the universe, that we have men, women, children living on the streets and unfortunately dying on the streets. Homelessness is, of course, up because poverty is up, Mark. We know that one in four Baltimore City residents, 25%, lives at or below 100% of the federal poverty line, which is about $11,000 for a single adult. About $24,000 for a family of four. We know that one in three Americans lives at or below 150% of the federal poverty level. So not only are more Americans and Baltimoreans poor, but more are near poor and having extreme difficulty paying for food, shelter, clothing, putting food on the table for their children. And more people are turning to an already overburdened shelter system that can't accommodate everyone's needs, or they're turning to the streets. We at Healthcare for the Homeless know that people experiencing homelessness are 3 to 4 times more likely than you or I to die prematurely.
One of the things that struck me when they last week moved all the people out of Occupy Baltimore, that of the 40 people that were there in tents when they moved in, the police moved in and moved them out, didn't arrest anybody but moved them all out, that 23 of those people said that, yes, you can take me to a homeless shelter, which meant that who was left there, the majority of people there, maybe more than the 23, were homeless citizens of the city who found a place where they could live safely, get a decent meal, have a porta potty around the corner, get a shower, live in some kind of community. There were homeless people who were taking over that space.
Occupy Baltimore, they were supporting the homeless community because they let them come down there and stay. They fed them, and they treated them like people. When the cops came in there and raided homeless Occupy, what happened was they came in there at 3:13 in the morning, and at 3:13 in the morning, you're not going to find any place to go for the night. So, you know, those people were left out on the streets. You know, the problem with this thing is that we don't have adequate housing at fair market value. You know, we are outpricing people from housing. We have people that work 7 days a week, some of them, or they work 40 hours a week, and they still can't afford an efficiency apartment on $7.25 an hour. But yet, the city or the federal have not raised the minimum wage. You know, for a person to live in Baltimore City and actually to be able to afford an efficiency apartment at fair market value, mm-hmm. they have to make around $15 an hour. So if you're only making $7.25 an hour, you're nowhere near getting what you actually need.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I totally agree with what James has to say. In my neighborhood in Baltimore City, it has one of the highest concentrations of urban poverty, not in the city, not in the state, but in the country.
Where's that?
That's Pigtown.
You live in Pigtown.
I work in Pigtown.
You work in Pigtown.
Yeah, that's where Paul's Place is located.
Right.
And we have two programs that we frame as homelessness prevention programs, a utility assistance program and an eviction prevention program, both designed to keep people in the housing that they currently have and prevent that trauma of the homelessness experience. We collect data on the people that come to us and to access those programs. And what we're seeing is a lot of working poor folks who are paying 80% of their income goes towards just rent and utilities, leaving just a small percentage for things like food, clothing, health care. So James really brought to light two major factors, I think, that contribute to homelessness is the lack of affordable housing in this city and the fact that people don't have livable wages.
Go ahead.
We find it at Healthcare for the Homeless, where we provide comprehensive medical care, mental health services, addiction treatment, dental care, pediatric and adolescent services, that if we're able to provide those that come to us for care with three things, access to a decent affordable housing unit, an apartment, a home somewhere, even sharing with others, access to comprehensive health care, and some sort of modest income, either help someone get back to work or help someone get disability assistance, we can end their homelessness. We do it every day. The problem is we're doing so, as was mentioned, in this broader economy that's causing more and more people to struggle to find these three basic essential resources, housing, healthcare, and jobs. And that's the very phenomenon that's forcing an increasing number of people to an overburdened shelter system or the streets. When I started doing this work about 2 decades ago, seeing a homeless kid, and we saw them, but was rare. Today it's routine. Today we're seeing a rapid increase in the number of children at every age experiencing homelessness.
Yeah. You told me with families and some without families.
With families and some on their own, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. James?
Right now, children are the largest or fastest growing part of the homeless situation. You know, parents can't keep these kids in a school because they have to move from place to place to place. Mm-hmm. And the child is not getting the education that it needs so that it can do better in their life. You know, I think that the city is not doing a very good job at addressing the problem of homelessness. Now, they opened the Weinberg Center for Housing and Development mm-hmm. on Fallsway, and they were supposed to be putting people in housing after 120 days.
And what happened?
It's way after 120 days, and nobody has went to housing yet. We were trying to get a meeting with the mayor or Tommy Hires about this here, because they said that they could do this, and we want to hold them to that, you know, because it's too many people out there, you know, sleeping in the streets at night. And as you said earlier, we have about 40 abandoned buildings out there.
30,000 to 40,000 abandoned buildings.
Yeah, and we would ask that we let people who are experiencing homelessness that have some skills in that area, and even if you don't, you can put them to work rehabbing the houses, and also they'll be working towards their apprenticeship license, so they'll have a piece of paper saying, I can do something. But if we do it the way we're doing it now, that 113 people will probably be 130 next year.
James puts his finger on the real problem. It's the lack of affordable housing. And as a nation, we've gotten out of the affordable housing business, Mark. We're spending about 40% today of what we spent for housing in 1979, 40%. Without too much surprise, people then are finding it impossible to find an affordable, safe place to stay and are turning to other places. On our front porch at Healthcare for the Homeless, under the Jones Falls Expressway, unfortunately, on park benches. And when they're out on the streets in weather like this, whether it's 13 degrees, 20 degrees, 32 degrees, it's pretty darn cold.
Right.
And people are experiencing extreme health-related problems, and some of them are dying because of it.
So, you know, we'll talk a bit about what your groups do in a minute here, because I'm, the listeners know what kind of things are being done and what you do. But so so rather than the – and this is not diminishing the incredible work that any organization does. I mean, Healthcare for the Homeless has created clinics and creative writing programs and spaces for people to live and giving people homes and gotten people out of homelessness and has taken very kind of radical populist positions and pushing for the rights of poor citizens in this – economically poor citizens in this community. And so it's become a very important organization. I think it's done more than most. And the mayor – and this is Commission on Homelessness that is supposed to be finding a solution so there's no more homelessness in the city that then Mayor Dixon helped launch. But so what about that? I mean, what are the systemic changes that have to take place to end this? I mean, I know you were just talking a minute ago, James, about the housing. You know, I mean, this is – what are the things we have to do? What are the ideas about how you end this?
Well,
if we can even in a city.
It is a three-pronged situation. Well, what we first have to do is get people off the street. We have to get people into housing because when people go into housing – their health gets better. They are able to take their medicines. Like if you are diabetic and you don't have housing, your insulin is not going to be any good to you.
And you refrigerate it?
Yes.
Right.
And if you walk around the streets with the syringes in your pocket, the cops are going to lock you up saying you got a drug paraphernalia. So, you know, or if you take morphine or anything like that there for pain and they see you with that bottle in your pocket, they're going to think you selling it. So, you know, you're going to lock them up and put another obstacle in front of them in getting housing. You know, when they put people out of these high rises, and what they said they was going to rebuild them, right? So then they didn't do that. They started saying we're going to make a mixed income neighborhood.
Right.
Well, they put 20% of the housing aside for low-income people, but you put 100% of them out on the street. So when you put the 20% in, you still have 80% without housing. You know, so doing the right thing is put the people that you put out on the street back in the housing, and it would cut a lot of this stuff out. You know, we wouldn't have 113 people who have died in the city because of housing, lack of housing.
What's so interesting about the city's 10-year plan to end homelessness, you mentioned that, Mark, is that it's really centered on this housing-first approach that James is talking about. You know, for decades, we've been set up as a service system more on a housing readiness approach, right, that looks at fixing the problem, treating the addiction, treating the mental illness, solving the healthcare problems, and then eventually moving someone into housing. What Housing First does is it flips that on its head. We've housed more than 200 people at Healthcare for the Homeless who are duly diagnosed with addiction, mental health, and also have some co-occurring medical problems. No precondition of treatment there. We put them in housing first, give them very intensive services, and what we found now is even after 5 years, 85% of those individuals stay housed and off the streets. Housing is fundamentally the solution to homelessness, and that's a concept that it seems intuitive perhaps to you or I, but is gaining ground finally nationally from the highest levels of the federal government to the Rawlings-Blake administration here in Baltimore City.
Yeah, I agree. You know, housing is the solution. Access to health care is the solution. Livable incomes are the solutions. And we can fix this problem. It just takes the political will to enact the policies to make it happen. I mean, we are a country that is awash in resources, and we make clear decisions about how we want to spend those resources. We have a Defense Department that gets, you know, spends more money and gets more money than the rest of the world combined. That is a decision that we make as a society about how we want to allocate our resources. And so I think we absolutely can solve this problem. We just need the political will to shift those resources towards housing, health care, livable incomes.
Absolutely. You know, we've kind of been led to believe or fooled ourselves into believing that homelessness is this big, messy, complex problem, right? It's so complicated. It's so difficult. Homelessness isn't all that difficult to solve. It really isn't. Housing, healthcare, and jobs, those three things, and a robust safety net that can keep people who are currently experiencing homelessness up off the streets where they don't suffer health-related problems. If we can redirect resources, as Julia said, that we're already spending toward improving the health and well-being of our most vulnerable neighbors, and in fact, in this economy of ourselves, as an increasing percentage of the middle class find themselves with no place to go, we can end homelessness. This is pretty simple stuff. This isn't rocket science.
But how do we get to the housing people need? I mean, that's one of the things that you've been talking about. I mean, how do we get there? How do we get to the place where there actually are affordable places for people to live in the city of Baltimore? That's the bottom line.
Well, one thing I would say is there's a piece of legislation that has been introduced in the Maryland General Assembly. It's going to be reintroduced this coming session, called the Maryland Home Act, which is a bill that would prohibit landlords and people selling properties from discriminating based on a person's source of income. So there's several places here in the state of Maryland where a person has one of those precious Section 8 vouchers that would make housing affordable for them, and they can't find a landlord in the county that they're living that will accept that Section 8 voucher.
So what do you – I mean, let's talk about that for just a second. I mean, there was an email blast that came out from Antonia Fasanelli from the Homeless People's Representation Project, which talked about this issue and then about the landlords not taking Section 8 vouchers. And then some papers asked the question. Did you see that? About whether or not they should be forced to take Section 8 housing. And the flood of people saying, no, you can't – I don't want these people living next to me. And you can't force a landlord to put Section 8 – people with Section 8 housing vouchers – in their properties because they don't know how to take care of them. They're loud, they're boisterous, they drink too much, and they make a mess of the community. So that's the will that that is out there on some levels.
I know not only does it affect Section 8, but they will not take people on SSI, SSDI. If you are retired and getting a pension from your job, they won't take that. They will not take people who receive a pension from the VA or that are receiving medical assistance from the VA. So they have a whole gamut of people that they say they're not going to rent to just because where they get their income from, and it's a legal form of income. We should not allow people to do that. You know, if I can pay the rent in a facility, then I should be able to rent that apartment. You know, I'm especially when I'm not out there, you know, bringing a whole lot of people in there and acting up and caring, you know, because that happens, yes, but it happens less than what people try to put it out there as, you know,
I mean, but this goes against the great American tradition of private property. It's my property. I can do what I want with it. I can rent who I want to, and you can't tell me what to do. Right? So how do you respond to that?
Well,
not to say I'm advocating, but how do you respond to that? Because that is the power of the mindset that we have here.
Well, I would argue that we have a perception problem. And the problem is that we perceive poor people as being defective in some way. Like there's something wrong with them that they are living in poverty. And they bring with them all of these nuisance type behaviors. They're loud. You know, maybe there's drugs going in and out of the apartment. Mm-hmm. You know, they don't take care of places and leave them in disrepair. And I agree with James that that does happen sometimes. There are certain people who, for a variety of reasons, don't take care of a property. There's people who have money who don't take care of their property. I would argue that we need to do some work. It's true. We need to do some work to change the perception of who people are who are receiving housing vouchers, who people are who are the working poor, and what their lives are like.
If you look at some of the properties in the city that are actually held by absentee landlords that aren't taking care of them, I think that's affirmation of your point that people with money don't often take care of their properties. I think the survey that you're mentioning in the Sun, Mark, is also reflects some very real stereotypes. We find that when we can return people to housing and give them the support that they need to be productive members of the community, they get back into the mainstream and integrate themselves back into that community. Experiments that James mentioned that we've had all throughout Baltimore City of mixed income communities, I think, is bearing that out, where you have people at varying socioeconomic levels living together in a community, and that creates a much more robust community. The problem is when we created those mixed income units, as James said, those mixed income communities, we didn't create enough of them. And we structurally tore down all of the old high rises simply because there wasn't enough federal money. You asked what we can do. We need to be directing a lot of our advocacy on the federal level to get behind the National Affordable Housing Trust Fund, to restore funding to the Department of Housing and Urban Development so that communities like Baltimore, communities all over the country, can provide subsidized housing to low-income families and adults so that we can end this nonsense of homelessness and put our resources elsewhere.
The National Affordable Housing Trust Fund, that was passed back in 2008, but they have not put the money in it yet. You know, passing the bill is one thing, but put the funding in there. That way we can get people off the street. We didn't fight all this way just so you could put your John Hancock on there.
Right.
We want some action. And I just don't understand how the powers to be in Washington can sit around and act as though this homeless problem does not exist. And actually they blame the homeless for being in that position. You know, I was homeless for 3 years. You know, I never remember saying, you know what, I want to become homeless. You know,
you didn't say that?
No, I don't remember that one, you know. But once I got involved and I came down here and I went to McVets, they were able to help me to get my mental and my physical health together. They also was able to help me to get identification, because if you don't have a home and you don't have identification, you can't get it. Because when you go down to the DMV, they want to see a birth certificate and a Social Security card. But the Social Security people want to see a birth date, a birth certificate, and a picture ID. And if, you know, it's just that round circle. So if you don't have a place to go and you don't have an address, you're not going to get the help you need, even if you're reaching out to the safety net programs that are there. So there's another reason why we need to put people in housing. You know, I just look at it as Kevin said, it's very simple, you know. It is, you know. Like I said, you put people to work rehabbing these housings, and they work towards their apprentice a license. You know, now you have people in your city that can do something because they went and studied that. Right now, that's not happening. You know, we ought to get on the people that are shifting in jobs overseas. Now, they shift them overseas and they pay somebody $100 a year, but when they bring it back here, they want to charge you top dollar for it, you know. And plus, they're getting tax rebates for creating jobs, but they're not creating the jobs here.
So, I you know, as we look at this this 10-year plan, I always worry about these things because I see 10-year plans, and as you were talking about, James, there are often 10-year plans that have no teeth. The teeth meaning they have no money to put in there to make the bite work so you can get something done. So, I mean, that to me is really the crux of this. Whether you were talking about, Julia, earlier, the bill that's going to be, say, legislature this session, which is to say that people hold Section 8 vouchers, that landlords have to take those vouchers and allow them in the buildings to rent apartments or homes. That and where the money goes to kind of rehabbing our city. I mean, those are things that really, those are really where the rubber meets the road, the issues that have to be dealt with if we're going to put a dent, not a dent, if we're going to end the idea of homelessness. I mean, because I think we can end homelessness if we're serious about it.
Ending homelessness is entirely possible, Mark. It's a matter of resources and it's a matter of priorities. I want to go back to this concept of the 10-year plan. You and I have talked about five or six of them over the years, I think. 10-year plans to end homelessness, manage homelessness, mitigate homelessness, reduce homelessness, whatever the catchphrase of the time happened to be. Most of them are yellowing on our bookshelves, right? The pages are brittle. If you look at them, though, almost every single one has the same four sets of recommendations. And we've talked about them on this program: affordable housing, comprehensive health care, livable incomes, and an adequate safety net. What's different, I think, about this current 10-year plan to end homelessness is that there's an organization behind it. The mayor has officially endorsed it. The United Way is behind it. Sister Helen Amos of Mercy Medical Center chairs the leadership advisory group made up of influential people throughout the city that all have come together to say, yes, these are the right goals. We can end homelessness. I think the real next step is figuring out how to translate that energy and that commitment into the advocacy necessary, perhaps on the federal and state level, and the local resources necessary to actually construct housing, get people the health care they need, get people back to work.
We're about to take a short break. We're here with James Crawford, Julia Hartenstein, and Kevin Lindemood talking about Homeless People's Memorial Day, which is today. The reading of the names will take place at the Inner Harbor. In the, what's that thing called?
The Inner Harbor Amphitheater.
The Inner Harbor Amphitheater.
5:30 tonight.
And we will come back after this brief break, and we'll be reading the names of the 113 people who died homeless in Baltimore this year. And the year's not over. Welcome back. Here we are talking about homelessness in our city. This is Homeless People's Memorial Day. Every year we do this program. We read the names of those who passed away on our streets or in Baltimore who were homeless. And there are 113 names that we'll be remembering today. And you can also go down to the Inner Harbor and be there as they read the names and remember people who died because of homelessness. 113 names, 113 people, not names, 113 human beings who died because of homelessness. We're here with James Crawford, who spent 3 years homeless himself. He's a veteran. He's lead organizer for Be More Housing for All, a grassroots campaign of people experiencing homelessness in Baltimore. Kevin Lindemood, who's with us, he's president and CEO of Healthcare for the Homeless, recently took that job. As you said earlier, deep shoes to fill. Jeff Singer has been the man who founded it and built this organization. He was an amazing human being, as you are. And he's done a great deal of great work.
Honored to be mentioned in the same sentence.
Amen. Mm-hmm. And Julia Hartenstein, lead organizer of the Memorial Day service and a case manager at St. Paul's Place. Mm-hmm. So and every year we do this, it's just as shocking to even read the names of human beings who are brothers and sisters to us all who are gone.
I'm really struck in looking at this list, Mark. Every now and then I come across a name of someone I knew, someone we worked with at Healthcare for the Homeless. And one name on this list, Wardy Smith, was an individual who experienced homelessness in Baltimore for many years. One of his legs was amputated. He got around on crutches. Wardy ended up getting into housing. Going back to work, he volunteered at a couple of local nonprofits, and he joined our board. He was on our board for a number of years, living in his own place, had ended his homelessness, had reconnected with family, and then unfortunately suffered a brain tumor, and the cancer spread, and Wardy passed away just this year. It's striking every time we read these names, which are actually people. But then when you know, the three of us have had relationships with some of the people on this list, it's particularly striking.
Yeah. And one thing that we try to do in the past couple of years with the memorial service that's down at the Inner Harbor is we try to capture just a few sentences about some of the people that we remember that tries to convey the essence of who these people were in the world. Because as you say, these are not just names on a list. These are living people who were living and breathing members of our community and connected to
somebody's
us.
Somebody's children, somebody's brother, sister, mother, mm-hmm. father.
We'll actually have 113 pair of shoes down there, I understand, to actually symbolize that there were once people standing in these shoes.
Mm-hmm. James, you're about to say what?
I was thinking about, when you read those names and I was listening to it, I found out that there were some people other people that I know who passed away that I didn't know about. Mm. You know, and it's like chilling effect on you. It's like, wait a minute, when did that happen? How could that happen? You know, but it does because of the way the system is ran right now. You know, the system like to blame the poor for the downturn in the economical situation. Well, it wasn't the poor that was stealing the money, okay? It wasn't the poor that was shipping the jobs overseas. It wasn't the poor that who were, you know, fixing all these deals with one another and all this, you know, backroom shenanigans. It wasn't the poor doing that, you know? But yet and still, people want to blame the poor for that. Now, in Baltimore City, they have a thing called TDAP, Temporary Disability, and it's $185 a month.
Right.
Okay? Now, when people apply for SSI or SSDI, you know, they have to file for that. And the thing is, it's not money that is given away freely, because when the person gets their whatever service they want, then they have to pay the money that the state gave them back. So it's a loan. It's not like you getting something for free. But yet and still, we have people that are hollering and screaming about that. And try to live on $185, $180 a month.
You know, try to live on $180 a week.
Yeah. You know, it's impossible. You know, but yet and still, they want to put the heaviest weight of the downturn in the economical situation on the back of the poor.
So it is true. I mean, I wonder what kind of – I mean, we talk about the kind of things that would be pushed in the legislature, but what else has to be done? Sometimes people don't hear things unless things are done to wake people up.
Well, we at Be More Housing for All, we are a grassroots group. And we started out very small, but now we have about 50 members. And we've gotten went to churches, went to schools, you know, colleges. And we talk to people about the plight of the homeless and how it happens and how it can happen to anyone, you know. And we get a lot of response from that. So now we have college students that come. We have clergy that come, and we have people that live in the neighborhood that come to our meeting. That's how we – but it started out with maybe five or six of us, and we stuck with it. And now it's then blossomed into something that has we think has some power. And we teach people how to testify when they go to Annapolis on a bill, because we believe if we put somebody up there to testify on a certain bill – because they are living proof of what is lacking in that bill. I think the people in the Senate and the delegates, they have to look at it a little different, you know, because now it's not a name on a piece of paper or now it's not some numbers. Now you're seeing people who are actually affected by the decisions that they make.
You know, events like Homeless Persons Memorial Day mark this service tonight at the Inner Harbor are incredibly important. There will be hundreds of people from all over the community. I mean, this isn't just something that Healthcare for the Homeless is organizing. This is made up of a broad cross-section of the community, public officials, faith leaders in the community, service providers all throughout the city. And there will be members of the general public who come down to the Inner Harbor Amphitheater and join people tonight reading the 113 individuals, the names of 113 people that died while experiencing homelessness. If that's all we do, though, if all we do is go and you know, reflect on how sad this is and remember the people that died, if that's all we do, we will have failed this evening. What we all have to do is get up tomorrow and get up the day after that and commit ourselves and recommit ourselves, not just to managing this phenomenon of homelessness, but to find ways to end it, to get people into housing, to get people the health care they need, to get people back to work. How can we use this day, this Homeless Persons Memorial Day, to actually be both educational in nature and inspirational in nature, capable of creating the kind of world we all ultimately want to live in?
How have you were alluding to it earlier, all of you, but how are you seeing the changing face of homelessness in this community from when you all either experienced it or have been working with it?
I'm seeing pretty dramatic changes. I've actually only been doing this work 3 or 4 years, but what I'm seeing coming through the doors of Paul's Place are, like I said, people who have never had to ask for assistance before in their lives. People are telling me that, you know, I have always worked. I have always paid my bills. And they're just so lost. They don't know where to turn for help. They don't know how to navigate the system. Plus, they're dealing with taking ownership of that new identity of themselves. You know, as someone who is now a receiver. You know, maybe they've always seen themselves as a contributor to society, and now they're one of those folks that is on the receiving end. And that is a shift when you start to see yourself differently in that way. I would also point out that we're seeing families that, you know, becoming homeless. One of the service providers in the SHARP Coalition, which is the coalition that's of service providers and advocates that sponsors Homeless Persons Memorial Day here in Baltimore City, one of our service providers reported recently that during the month of September, they saw 127 new families to them report as homeless in 1 month. That's 1 month.
Wow. One center in 1 month.
Yes. A big shift.
It's a huge shift, and you know you ask the question about the changing face of homelessness. Mark, homelessness has been changing over the past 30 years. When Healthcare for the Homeless started, the large majority of the people we were seeing were single adult men. More than 85% of our clients back in the early 90s, single adult men, less than 15% women. Today, well over a third of the people we see every day at Healthcare for the Homeless are women. And we're seeing an increased percentage of children experiencing homelessness and entire intact families coming into a system, you know, as Julia mentioned, that really was set up to serve single adults more. There's far more resources for that population. And now we've got more and more families who are blinking and wide-eyed. How do I navigate the system? And really, there's no room for me and my family in this system. So instead, I'm knocking on doors. I'm doubling up with friends, neighbors, relatives. I'm going to the Department of Social Services and asking for assistance. And the list is so long of people that have signed up before me that I can't really get the help that I need. That's a problem that we're facing now as a community with more and more people that never thought they'd experience homelessness coming into the system for the first time. How are we going to manage it tonight on an emergency basis? And then how ultimately are we going to reverse this trend so that we don't see this phenomenon continuing further?
Yeah, I also see a lot of people that are suffering from mental health problems. Back in the Reagan years, they closed all the sanitariums and put the people on the street. And now I see homeless people who need that kind of help. But also, what happens when you're homeless, you also get some kind of a mental illness. You know,
when you become homeless, you're saying.
Yes.
Right, right.
Yes, because now you're in a position that you never dreamed you would be in. And then when you go to get some help, you can't get help because you don't have the right piece of paper. And then trying to get that piece of paper, well, they don't deliver mail in behind the third dumpster at McDonald's. You understand? You
right.
have to have a
right. right.
You know, you have to have a real address.
Yeah.
And for people to be out in the street and trying to survive, because you don't live, you survive. You know, we have people that have all kinds of disease out there. And when they go to eat someplace, the only thing they are being fed is starch. And that starch turns into sugars. If you're diabetic, you're in trouble. If you have heart problems, you're in trouble. If you have high blood pressure, you're in trouble. Even though you need to eat to be filled so that you can, you know, slug on through the day, try to make something happen. But you're not getting the right kind of food, you know. And then when you have children and they're in school and you don't have a place to take them, how are they going to do their homework? You know, you can't do the homework underneath a street lamp. You need to be in a house where you feel safe and where you can take the time that is needed to do this. But the homeless community don't have that. You know, and like I said earlier, children are the fastest growing population in the homeless community. You know, and if we as a society are going to let our children live in the street, then what kind of society are we?
And I'm curious, as a grassroots organizer in this community, what is your day filled with? What do you do?
Well, sometimes I'm going down to the shelter that they just built, and I'm taking people's grievances down there because now we have them to bring the grievances over to Be More Housing for All. We make a copy of it, and we give the shelter a copy, and we keep a copy. We keep the original. And, you know, after a certain length of time, you know, if nothing's done, well, I ask the person, what did they take care of that for you? And if they didn't, then I go back down there, and they can't say they didn't get a copy of the because I gave it to them, you know. But see, that's what was happening with people down there, that they would turn in the grievance slip, and it gets thrown away. Or people want to know, what is that grievance slip for? And I told, you don't have to tell them that, you know. Then other days I'm going to different meetings, Baltimore United Congregations, SHARP, you know, Physicians for a National Healthcare Program. I go, it's a whole lot of meetings that I'm at, but what most of them are dealing with is poor people, you know, because you couldn't tell me before I became homeless that I would ever do that, because I was changing cars. My wife and I changed cars every 2 years. You know, we went into the store. We didn't look at the prices. If we wanted it, we brought it, you know.
So how did you end up homeless?
I was hit by a tractor trailer. I was working for an insurance company. I was the vice president of the underwriting department. And I got hit by a tractor trailer on my bicycle training for a triathlon. And I was broken up. And the company that I worked for moved out of state. When they moved out of state, I lost my insurance. So being that I had to learn how to walk and all this again, all of my savings went. And I still needed the treatment, so I had to sell my home. You know? And you know, then my wife and I, we split. And I just didn't have enough money to take care of everything that I needed. You know, they wanted me to come back to therapy for another year, and I couldn't do it because I didn't have the money. You know, and I was in Pennsylvania, and if you're a single man in Pennsylvania, you get nothing, you know. Now at least here you get $185.
Right.
There you're not gonna get a dollar, you know. So yeah, And when I, while I was homeless, and when I got to a place, I wasn't looking for a handout. I was looking for a hand up. You know, I knew that if I can get up on my feet, then I'll be able to take care of me again. But I just needed that chance to sit still and get my physical and mental health in order so that I could go out and do something.
Mark, we remain, as you know, the only industrialized nation that doesn't provide access to comprehensive health care as a right of residency. And as James's story illustrates, there's this very close relationship between homelessness and health. Poor health can, in fact, cause homelessness, as it did in his case. And once you're experiencing homelessness, you're likely to get sick. If you're already sick, as was James, quite wounded, you're likely to get sicker. And then it becomes very complicated to provide treatment and continuity of care. Where do you keep your medications if they have to be refrigerated and you're living in a homeless shelter or under the Jones Falls Expressway? So there's this very clear relationship between homelessness and health. 75% of the people that we see every year at Healthcare for the Homeless lack comprehensive health insurance. 75%. Health reform may change that in 2 years, but we have to all work to make that a reality.
And as you know, I think that your story here a minute ago, James, was important. I mean, because, you know, we have this face of still the popular notion of what it means to be homeless. Mm-hmm. You know, and just because you're African American with dreads, people say, oh, that's why you're homeless, right?
Well, there's
a public perception,
yeah.
Right?
Yes, it is. You know, and then when I tell people that I'm an honorably discharged veteran from the Navy and I went to Vietnam, I have a college degree, you know, and they're looking at me like, well, how can you have all
right.
that? But, hey, don't look at my outsides. You understand? Look at what's coming out. Look how I carry myself.
Well, James.
Go ahead.
I would just say that James is all of us.
Absolutely.
He is all of us.
Any of us could be there within months.
Right.
Any of us. At least I could.
Right. We're all living in that precarious
right.
place where one accident, one medical issue.
Lose a job, lose your income.
Right.
Any of those things.
Right. And you end up homeless on the streets.
Right.
And if not that there's any upside in this economy, but if there's any silver lining to be found here, I think it's that an increasing number of people, everyday mainstream folks that might not have thought about homelessness much, are beginning to understand it in a different way and are beginning to realize, wait a minute, there's maybe not that much separating us versus them. And that maybe that realization, that's why an event like this is so important tonight. These are human beings. Maybe that realization will lead us toward the kind of priorities, the kind of public policies that we need to make homelessness rare and breathe.
So we are here doing this today because it is Homeless People's Memorial Day. A service will be taking place in the amphitheater at the Inner Harbor this evening. We encourage people to go down there. 6 o'clock?
5:30.
5:30.
So as you're listening to this, they are heading down to be there. So you can join them there. This is a very important event. People from across the city, hundreds will show up to read the names and remember those who passed away because of homelessness in the city of Baltimore. 113 people, at least. There may be more. These are the ones we know that died who are homeless. So there may be many more than 113 people that we know of whose names we are going to read in a minute. I first want to thank our guests for being here. Kevin Lindemood, the new president and CEO of Healthcare for the Homeless.
Thanks for your leadership on these issues, Mark.
Pleasure to have you here always. Julia Hartenstein, good to meet you.
Thank you.
Who is lead organizer for today's Memorial Day service and case managers at Paul's Place, and James Crawford Jr., who spent 3 years homeless. You just heard his story. But he's lead organizer of Be More Housing for All, a grassroots campaign of people experiencing homelessness in Baltimore. It's a pleasure to meet you, man, and have you in the studio.
And you too. Let's not be this be the only time.
Amen to that. And as we do every year, we end our program by reading the names of those who passed away this year homeless. Some died in the streets, some died in homeless shelters, some died in various places where they were living.
Some might have been in their own homes in the last months of their lives.
And we will read this list to remember them on this Homeless People's Memorial Day. The names will still be read at Mount Vernon this year?
No. They'll be read downtown at the Baltimore Inner Harbor Amphitheater.
And that'll be?
This very this very evening, the 21st of December, which is the first day of winter and the longest night of the year.
So let us read the names and remember the men and women who passed away, the homeless who died in our community, 113 names. Alberto Aiza, Brandon Aragon, James Barley, Geraldine Barry, Evan Bart, Donald Bennett, Willie Billinger, Sylvia Bottom, James Bridgeford, Lydia Bird, Patrick Carberry, William Carroll, Wesley Carter, Ivory Corbett, Norris Courts, John Crawford, Carithia Cross, Deborah Davis, Angela Davis Gaines, Patricia DeShields, Oscar Delaney, Bernard Duperault, John East, Milton Eads, Dorsey Ebb, Thomas Eline, Bruce Elsezi, Thomas Everett, Gregory Flowers, Richard Flynn, Glenn Frank, Gary Galbo, Helen Galloway, Clarana Green, Edwin E. Green, Charles Griffin, Rodney Grissett, Vicky Hall, Johnny Hardy, Danelle Henderson, Theodore Hobday, Ronald Jackson, Tyrone Jackson, Dwight Johnson, Melvin Johnson, Tammy Johnson, Danielle Jones, Evan Gregory Jones, Larry D. Kennedy, Matthew Lazarus, Tyshell Lee, Ronald Lewis, John Levers, Richard Lofton, David Lorton, Mary Lowry, Gerald McGuire, Charles Manon, Edna Marshall, Cheryl McDonald, Steve McGuire, Sharon McKnight, Ernest Menigheim, Sean Mills, Carolyn Miller, Willie Nelson, Antonio Knock, James Novell Miller, Sean Mills, Gregory Oden, Yvette Ortiz, Anthony L. Owens, Henry Owens, Robert Paxton, Patsy Diane Person, Stanislaw Patak, Victoria Reagans, Joel A. Reeves, Robert Ricketts, Simon Rivers, James Robinson, Charles Royster, Stephen Ruby, Madeline Sanders, Michelle Sawyer, Robert Seabreeze, Joseph Skipper, Calvin Smith, Wardy Smith, John Swain, Alicia Taylor, Robert Spider Thames, Dave Thomas, Kenneth Thomas, Clarence Thompson, Tyra Trent, Ruth Tucker, Brett Vedukotakis, Howard Vincent, Michael Vitas, Danette Wallace, James Webb, Michael West, Kenneth Wheeler, George White, Alvin Whitehead, Danny Whitman, Tira Willis, Warren Wilmer, Charles Williams, Gregory Wise, Christopher Wood, Francis Young. All those who died homeless in Baltimore City, we remember you. May you rest in peace, and may it end soon. The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Justin Levy and Christina Arison. Our theme music is by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts. To hear this show again, podcast any of our past shows, hear additional interviews, please visit us on the web at steinershow.org. And for Public Radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.